Ladies and gents, we are here with the amazing John Button, who is in London playing with...
The Who.
How cool is this? Now, obviously, you've played with a ton of artists as well. Mm-hmm. Who are some of the artists that you're most proud of?
You're going to make me name drop.
I'm like super into Sheryl Crow. And
me
I was
too.
Like, ooh, John's played with Sheryl Crow.
That was amazing. That's other than The Who, that's probably...
Is that
the highlight,
up there?
Yeah.
But you played with like a slew of artists.
Yeah, I played with a couple people.
Couple of people.
I mean, I haven't played with a ton of people, but I've been around.
John, you play with enough. But how did you find the bass in the first place? Like, was it bass like from the get go, or was it another
almost.
Instrument?
Started piano at four. Musical family. Yeah.
Oh,
four.
I see. You come from musical family.
All older, four older siblings.
Yeah.
All great musicians. My parents played. I mean,
oh,
they weren't professional or anything, but
damn,
they all played.
Wicked.
So my oldest brother was a drummer, and he couldn't find any bass players to be in a band with in Fairbanks, Alaska.
Yeah.
Imagine that. So he bought a bass, and he let his 7-year-old brother, me, borrow his bass and play it, and I liked it. And that was it. Well, then my mom, being the brilliant person that she is, suggested I join the school orchestra in third grade.
When you were in school, were you thinking to yourself, oh, actually, I quite like that. I might be a professional musician.
No. Yeah, I was like, I'm going to be a professional musician.
Oh, you were,
no,
you,
I was like...
You were always going to be a professional musician. And what was it in what was it, Fair...
Fairbanks.
I don't even know what it's called.
Most people don't.
I'm going to be cast down because of that.
It's some tiny town in Alaska.
Yeah, what was the music scene there like? Was there other
what
people?
Music scene?
Was there no music scene?
Nah, there's a little bit. You know what there was? There was a very good... music in the schools program, because we had a lot of money from oil up there. A
lot of oil in Alaska.
Yeah.
A lot of trees, a lot of oil.
Yeah. So our schools were very well funded. So I had a great orchestra in third grade that I could join. I did the jazz band starting in seventh grade and really good like music education kind of situation.
Yeah.
But no like join a band and... There wasn't much of that.
So where did you, like at the end of that, you know, your schooling, what was your plan after that? Move to the big city and try and meet guys? Like, did you have some sort of plan?
I went to college. I went to University of North Texas.
Got you.
Which is a really good music school. And then I had my sights on moving to LA.
Yeah. What was it like going from Alaska to North Texas State?
It was crazy. Well, I drove myself. Was it 3,000 something miles?
Wow.
Yeah. But the crazy thing is, so you arrive at college in August.
Yeah.
It's like 195 degrees in Texas. And, you know, my car doesn't
like
have AC.
Another world, yeah.
Totally. My car did not have air conditioning. Yeah. My dorm, for some reason, didn't have air conditioning. So I was just like, I didn't know what to do with the heat.
Yeah,
it was an adjustment. But.
Where was your skill set when you actually got to university? Was it for instance, I spoke to Michael Lee a couple of weeks ago.
Right.
He said when he got there, he said, I was like the worst student. He said, I was the worst student.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah, he said he was terrible.
You know what's kind of interesting to me is I felt like being in Alaska, I was pretty isolated.
Yeah.
So I felt like I didn't know where I stood.
Because you didn't have sort of like a gauge.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I didn't know what to expect when I got there. And I did pretty well. I was pretty well acclimated.
So
when
your
I got
reading
there.
Was together and stuff like that
because
you were playing in the school band.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That just goes to show, folks, get your reading together.
Yeah, and then since college, I've used my reading not at all.
Yeah. Really? I was about to say.
Do very few reading gigs. I did a few, like, film sessions.
I was going to say, like, for film stuff.
Yeah, I did a bit of that, especially when I first moved to LA. I did a fair bit of that, but it's not really my thing.
Yeah.
For what I do now, I don't do any reading.
You don't
reading.
Do any reading. When you were
but new, I can.
What other skills did you learn when you were in college?
Playing in an ensemble, like playing with other players, like how to just kind of interact with other players and kind of be cohesive with
them. It's like full-on jazz college, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, was that what you were, you there to do that?
Yeah, when I was later in high school, I was really into jazz. Like I wanted to be like, straight ahead jazz guy.
Yeah. Upright, yeah. Mm. And were you playing upright in uni as well? Yeah, in college.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I gotta say, I kind of like North Texas. It seemed was like so jazz. I kind of got honestly burned out. yeah. I think, on jazz. And so I was kind of really focused on that for the first couple of years, and then I sort of like was like, yeah, maybe I want to be like a, you know, pop studio yeah. guy or something.
Because there was a big scene at the time as well, wasn't there?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was still going on, talk about this. Obviously, it's decreased over the, like, you know, the last, I would say, 15 yeah. to 20 years or something like
about
that.
About the time that I moved to LA is when it just...
Great.
Yeah, it's perfect.
Cheers, really guys. Cool. Yeah, so when you got burned out, like, was the decision made when you were at music school? Did you think, oh, maybe I should do more of a pop kind of session yeah. thing? It was actually while you were in school, mm-hmm. yeah.
Yeah. I think it was a combination of maybe burning out, and then also just sort of, I think, maybe becoming a fan of pop music.
Right.
Okay. You know, not being like, oh, that's just easy.
Yeah.
Pedestrian music, you know.
And yeah, because
becoming a fan again.
It can be pretty full on, can't it, when you get in them sort of like jazz schools. There is definitely a certain amount of elitism, snobbery totally. And competition within the students, possibly.
A bit, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it was there, yeah.
Yeah.
So when you moved to... And was it from LA straight from North Texas?
Yeah.
You moved down with the intention of, I'm going to be a session player, I'm going to play big pop gigs and stuff mm-hmm. like that. Did you learn, what translatable information and skills did you learn in school that could be taken over to a pop, rock session environment? Because tons of students will be watching and they might not have even thought of ever playing anything to do with jazz. And I think it'd be really interesting if they heard somebody that actually started off doing that and then, you know, moved into that world of sessioning. You know,
right. Like, well, I think one thing that you can take from playing jazz certainly is being able to be spontaneous.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, when you do sessions in LA, at least in my experience, you don't get the songs ahead of time. You don't rehearse. It's like, here's the song, record, you know, you run through it a couple times, but you need to be able to be quick on your feet.
Yeah.
And so I think playing jazz gives you that skill of sort of being able to kind of work on the fly and sort of be adaptable and flexible and kind of roll with the punches.
Yeah. And I suppose, well, you must have had certain amount of harmonic knowledge as well. Understanding.
For sure, yeah.
Chord sequences and, you know, what the theory, heck is a 1-2-5.
And also your ear, you know, ear training, all that. Being able to, you know, hear a song and be like, oh yeah, it's these chords.
Yeah, exactly. You know? And do you play any other instruments? Did you carry on playing piano?
Not very well. I plunked around a little bit.
But I'm a terrible guitar player. Could you play basic chords on piano?
Yeah, sure.
And do you feel that that has had any translatable positive effect to playing the bass?
Oh, for sure. Just the same stuff, the ear training, the, you know, being able to hear a chord and be like, yeah, that's this. Or if you want to play inversion, you know.
Yeah, because sometimes it's a bit abstract on bass, isn't it? You know, because playing chords, but a lot of the time it's like one note at a time.
Sure.
It's not, you know, like on guitar or piano where you just actually get to hear the chord. Like a lot of students I speak to, when they're like, what's the best thing to start with ear training? I'm just like, just play chords and get used to what a chord actually sounds like.
Totally. And being able to see it on the piano, super valuable.
Yeah, because it's kind of like a musical abacus, isn't it? On here, again, you've got like lots of notes that repeat themselves.
Piano makes sense.
Do you have any system of visualizing the fretboard, talking about being able to, you know, and I mean, like, are you thinking notes when you're playing, or do you think in patterns?
I think I'm not thinking, hopefully, too much. But I think often I move between thinking notes, thinking intervals, and almost more often than not, thinking sound, like, I think I have pretty good ears, you know? So I almost hear the stuff more than see
you hear
it.
The movement.
I want to play a minor third now, or the next chord is a fourth up.
Yeah.
I think is where my head is at. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Do you think that's actually been developed just over time?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Definitely it just through osmosis it happens, but also, I mean, I've done a lot of, you know, in college, there's ear training class, you know. Teacher sits at the piano and you have to write down what they're playing. You know, and that. And then also just learning songs off of records. I mean, back in the day.
Well, you just had to put a record on.
Exactly. You didn't have the app and the YouTube and, oh God, I sound so old.
I I'm telling you, man, we're still young in our 40s. It's all.
But yeah, you know, I think that was probably the main thing, was as a kid learning parts off of records.
Yeah, and that obviously really helped with your ear training. Do you ever get, when you turn up to a session, is there any, talk about learning songs, is there any general playbook or formula that they seem to happen in when you get booked? Do you get like stuff via MP3 and emails to learn? Do you get charts? No. Do you? So if anybody's watching this and they're in music school as you were, and they have any aspirations of working in the industry and recording for people, what should they be actually expecting on their end?
Well, so the first thing I think to compartmentalize is what kind of session is it?
Okay.
And most of the stuff I do now is like a pop song.
Yeah.
Singer has a song, want to do a record, whatever. So I just get booked. Usually the conversation is, hey, I'm going to bring my B-15 and this, you know, DI and blah, blah, blah. Great. See it 2 o'clock.
Yeah.
So then you show up.
So that's up. A lot of the pre-communication is just sort of like, I'm going to turn up. You've got these times, you know, the studio is. Mm-hmm. Do you do like a gear check? Are you like, what type of gear do you want me to bring? Or?
Sometimes, yeah. Yeah, usually I'll, if it's not somebody I've worked with before, like I have a few producers that I work with regularly that kind of know what kind of things I might bring. So they might say, hey, bring your upright.
Right.
Or hey, bring a fretless. Or, so if it's not somebody I've worked with, I'll sort of get a gauge of like, do I need a 5-string?
Yeah,
usually not for me.
Yeah.
You know, I'm kind of the like, you know, old school, like I'll bring some like pawn shop goofy basses and weird stuff.
Yeah.
That's kind of my thing.
They're booking you and they generally know what they're
They're
booking.
Yeah. I'm not the guy showing up with like the active 6-string thing, you know.
Yeah.
So anyway, so I'll get a vibe of what I'm going to bring gear wise. So we get that. That's it. Usually no music, you know. And so you turn up at the studio, and most of the sessions I do, either the songwriter will play the song through on guitar, and we all write a chart as he plays it.
Sometimes the artist is there, you sit there, and you write your chart.
Yeah.
While they're playing it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or they'll play it on, you know, hit play on the Pro Tools, and this is where the ear training really comes in.
My secondary question was going to be, how much information, as they play that track to you or play it, how much information are you getting as you sit with your, you know, with your pad of paper?
Quite a bit.
Are they telling you a lot?
No, they don't.
They don't tell you. Okay.
Play.
And then you, maybe sort of like a starting chord. Hey, this starts with an E minor. Maybe, sometimes not. Yeah.
So, and it depends. Sometimes I'll have, you know, a hollow body bass and be like, oh yeah, it's G. But I mean, a lot of the guys that do session work, man, everybody's got killer ears and can just like write it out as it goes. And interestingly to me, lately, I started moving into doing Nashville numbers.
Okay.
Which is a really cool way of charting.
Yeah.
And I found that like sometimes if I'm charting out in whatever you call Roman, you know, just writing F and B flat and whatever, what I'd find is if the chords were moving fast, and it's in a key like A flat or something, A flat. I have to write two
things. So you're thinking
my hand can't keep up with what I need to, with my ear.
And I'm assuming you don't want to be the guy that says, hey guys, can you just stop while I'm catch up? Right,
I mean, you can, fine. But you don't want to be that guy.
Yeah,
you want to be the guy that's like, no problem, got it. So Nashville numbers, if it's in A flat, it's just 1, 4, 5. 1, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And there are other little shorthands for rhythm pushes and stuff. It's a really cool system.
I was going to say that you actually people call the number system as in sort of like chord 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. They call that the Nashville number system. Mm. But it's not the true picture, is it? Because the Nashville number system is exactly what you're talking about, where you do use the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, but then there's this whole slew of other information that you can use for pushes and whether something's a major or a minor four, and
it's
and more complex than it actually gets
a little
given.
Bit but in a way more simple, because the it conforms to a number being a whole bar. So if it's a bar of the one chord, you just write one, that's it.
Yeah.
And then if the next bar is a four, and then if it's two chords, you put an underline under it.
Yeah.
So there's...
See, it's all this... There's a lot of ninja stuff, actually.
There is, but once you get it down, it's like, yep, got it, going,
Where did you get it down?
I got a book by a guy that I went to North Texas with.
It's our drummer, isn't it? Yeah, what's the drummer called? He wrote a book on the National Drummer System.
Oh, God.
I think he does a video on YouTube, actually. If anybody wanted to check it out.
I forgot his name. I went to college with him and...
I think there's a video on YouTube and he's talking about the specific systems.
So, he's a Nashville drummer now, plays with some really big Nashville artists. And the book is great.
So you just got
go buy the book.
And then,
absolutely, it's fantastic. It lays out everything. It's got play along tracks and all this stuff.
Really?
Yeah, he just put his name.
Dan, just put his name underneath. Flashing yellow. Dan's giving us the thumbs up.
I'll get right on that.
Yeah. So when you're writing this down, you know, and you've got your, you know, you've got your chart. How many times through is a passable? Is it one?
Sometimes.
Yeah. Depending on how complex it is.
On average, it's you'd probably average out to 1.5. So some are one, some are. You know, if there's a lot of stuff, if there's riffs and stuff, then you're gonna have to figure all that out. But if it's a simple folk tune, one time.
And then when you're actually recording the track itself, how much scope have you got to be creative with it? And is that a conversation that you have with the producer and the artist? Or on the other side of it, are you just like, I'm just gonna nail it, keep it super simple, and just make sure that I sort of like get the vibe right? Is there a conversation that goes on or not?
Yes. Sure.
The reason why I'm being super detailed is for all the students watching it.
Yeah, of
course. Because they want to know it.
Well, yeah, it's like, what Knowledge happens is the key, these, right? Yeah, what happens at these studios? Yeah. It's so mysterious. Yeah,
they'll
totally.
Watch this interview and these, like, 17-year-olds will go in to do sessions. They'll be like, the producers are like, these guys are pro.
Yeah, right? Awesome.
These guys are awesome.
Take all my gigs. Part of it you kind of feel out. You can kind of hear by the song. I mean, if it's a singer-songwriter that's playing a real simple acoustic guitar song, you're not going to be like, yeah, you want all these jazzy licks, right? But if there's somewhere in the middle, you have a conversation with the producer like, hey, sounds like maybe might be cool to do this. What do you think of that?
Yeah.
Oftentimes, with a producer that knows you and trusts you, they'll trust you to do your thing. That's the best thing to do, is let the guys do what they do and then go, hey, let's steer you in a direction, not to try and rein people in before they even figure out what they're doing.
Absolutely, because sometimes you'll be booked for what you're going to bring to that session, especially with a producer that you've worked with before.
Totally.
Let's get John because we know that he's going to do that kind of vibe.
Yeah.
With that in mind, I think this would be really interesting for the guys here. Was there ever a conscious move in that direction where you thought to yourself, I don't want to be the guy with the 6-string active bass. I want to be known for, I want to work in this kind of, this kind of like space within the industry. I'm going to play a P bass or a Rickenbacker. Was that ever a conscious decision?
To an extent, I think part of that stems from just what I'm into. Yeah. As a person, I like kind of old basses and meat and potato stuff, and that's the kind of music I like, kind of more organic kind of stuff. Yeah. I don't listen to gospel music. Nothing against that. It's not
your vibe. Yeah.
But having said that, I think there's also maybe especially in LA, I think people get kind of pigeonholed, and so there's a certain amount of, for lack of a better term, branding. I'm kind of comfortable being the guy that shows up with old basses and a hollow body and a, 65 B-15 and, kind of that organic kind of thing.
And we can unearth some secrets here, John.
I'm an open book.
Dude, was there ever a time where you did have like a 5 or active 6-string?
I have a 5,
sort of like, I don't know, like long hair. I had long hair.
I was rocking it.
When you first hit LA, did you know what you were aiming for? Did you know what the target was? Or you were just sort of like feeling as you went and just...
I don't think I had found sort of my vibe or my voice quite yet.
So you didn't know where you were going to fit.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think I was a little just sort of more middle of the road.
Yeah.
When I landed in LA, yeah.
And how important is it, do you think, for people, like music students, people that are getting into the industry, how important do you think it is for those guys to actually identify what they want to be and, for a lack of a better term, I suppose, brand themselves? Because, let's be honest, right, you wouldn't be playing with The Who if you were rocking a six-string active bass. So it's obviously played a big part in your career so far.
Yeah.
So how important is it for students to do that?
I think that depends on where you're living, in a way, and what kind of stuff you're doing.
Got you.
You know, I mean, in a big town like LA, there's enough people where it's like, yeah, I'll get this guy for this guy for this, you know?
You can niche down, yeah.
Yeah, but if you're living, you know, off somewhere and jobbing around doing all kinds of different... I mean, you kind of have to do all kinds... You know, you got to play a wedding on Saturday and play in church on Sunday and, you know, do the blues gig on Tuesday.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? So I would say if you're in a sort of smaller market, you kind of have to be a little more of a jack of all trades.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Wouldn't you say? I mean...
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think... Like, my personal opinion is that I think it really helps to have, to not try and be a jack of all trades, like, be able to do it,
right,
but then also have some kind of foundation of, like, just basically don't be a bad version of everybody.
Right, you know?
Instead of being a bad version of everybody, be able to sort of, like, you know, get on a Latin gig and be able to play. You might not be a Latin guy, but, you know, be able, if somebody says, hey, it's like a samba type of thing, you want to be able to know what a samba is, you know, and be able to play that stuff, or a bossa nova, or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
But also have somewhat a personality behind your playing, because that's what you're going to get booked for as well. People are like, you know, John might sound wicked on this because he's got that kind of vibe. So I think there's a way of doing both.
Yeah.
In a way.
Yeah, no, totally. And also, I think having a sort of discovering and becoming familiar with all kinds of different music, even if you're like, this is my thing, checking out bossa novas and all this other stuff, you know, just can make you better at that thing you're doing. Yeah. You know, it informs everything you're
all
doing.
All those skills are kind of like translatable. If you're doing a Latin thing and it's quite sort of like, it's not complex, well, it could be complex rhythmically, but it's going to be a little bit different because you're probably not going to be playing on the one all the time because everything's syncopated. Right. And that's going to transfer to other styles of music.
Right.
And it's going to, you know, strengthen your time feel and your rhythm and your concept of groove and stuff like that.
And you might be able to come up with creative things, you know, some weird hybrid of, you know, something that somebody might not think of if all they listened to was this one.
Yeah, exactly,
genre.
exactly that. So obviously, you know, in the studio, you're writing the charts and stuff like that. How have you got in the studio in the first place? How do you get the gigs? Let's talk about you when you first moved to LA, how you started to, you know, get into the scene and what you were doing, and then that compared with what your advice would be now if somebody's moving into a bigger city, LA, London, New York, Chicago, wherever it be.
Yeah, you know, I mean...
What did you do back in the day?
I mean, the main thing was I just said yes to everybody.
Yeah.
I was playing in like 9 different projects for free.
Yeah.
I mean, I had fortunately saved up some money from Texas. I had a pretty good gig there and low cost of living, so I had a little money that I could say yes to all these crazy free gigs. But yeah, I was just playing with everybody, you know. And so the drummer on this gig is like, John did a good job, he's good, let me get his number and I'll call him for this other thing that maybe pays $30. Now you're getting $30 instead of free, and then, you know, you just and just always trying to, you know, show up with your A+ game.
Yeah.
Always, for everything.
And what would that be? What, other than playing, is there anything else that contributes to sort of like, other than playing? Because I think sometimes...
Oh, I think the playing is almost second.
Yeah, that's my point. Because sometimes there's like all of this other stuff going on.
Think the other stuff is being prepared. So, you know, if you're doing a rehearsal with a singer-songwriter, you show up, you know the songs.
Yeah.
And you're on time. You took a shower. I don't know.
Yeah, you're cool guy.
Yeah, that's huge. Yeah. Huge.
Yeah.
Everybody talks about that, right?
Yeah.
It's like, you know.
Well, yeah.
You don't want to hire them. If some guy's a jerk, why are you going to refer him for a gig? You don't want him around, you know? So, yeah, being cool, on time, mainly just being prepared. Like, does your gear work? Is everything, you know, just being a pro.
And is there any advice that you give to your younger self moving into that situation now, looking back?
Ooh, no, I did everything perfectly.
You're like, John, you're a badass. Rinse and repeat.
No, I mean, God.
It's cool if that is the answer, man. It's cool.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it sounds awkward to say that, but I think I did all right.
Well, yeah. Dude, you're kicking with the hoots. Okay.
Wow. No, I mean, I think, yeah, I mean, I've always been somebody to be very prepared. I mean, my buddies that I go hiking with always joke about John's the guy with three coats.
I was going to say, you like the SES guy.
Seriously, you know, and they'll make fun of me until it starts raining and they all, hey, you got an extra coat? So, I mean, it kind of, that's just sort of part of my DNA. I think part of it comes from Alaska.
Yeah.
Because, dude, if you're not
prepared. It's colder as
best. Dude, you'll die. If you're on the way to school and you're not prepared, you'll die.
Is it crazy cold? Yeah, obviously.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you ever see a bear?
Yes. And I had, the scariest one was one that I didn't see because it was in the bushes.
But
it was
seriously?
Like, yeah, grizzly bear, like, right there. Yeah. Those grizzly bears are no joke.
Amazing. But how did you get the gig with The Who? When I saw that
I
you were playing
right
with The Who,
the
I was
right
like,
time,
how did
man.
That, how did you get that? What a cool
so,
gig.
Yeah, right? I've been playing with Roger Daltrey for like 10 years now. So I auditioned for Roger's thing. He was putting together a band to do a solo tour.
Yeah.
He wanted to put together a band in L.A. And a friend of mine thought I was a cool guy.
Yeah.
Recommended me to audition.
And when you went to the audition, another fascinating thing to talk about. When you auditioned, did you turn up and there was other bass players doing the same thing?
Oh, yeah.
You did.
A lot of other
bass players.
It was.
And what's that? What are you told beforehand when you go to audition for somebody like Roger Daltrey? Are you told a song to learn?
Yeah.
Yeah. Songs?
A few. Yeah. Yeah, it was interesting. I forget how many songs, but probably in the, I think they maybe said 5 songs.
Yeah.
Almost none of which we played on the audition.
Really?
I think we did maybe one or two
of
them.
I've heard that before, actually.
Yeah, and then Roger was like, let's just jam.
Intimidating?
Yeah, but you know, auditions are all, I guess it depends on the audition, like how big of a gig is it, what's the competition. But yeah, that was, you know, that was a big gig and a lot of really good bass players showing up.
Was the bass players that you knew? And you were like, oh my God,
most of
this
them.
Guy. Oh,
oh
wow,
yeah.
Okay.
Well, we're all pals, you know. You want to know a story?
You know I do.
So, auditioning for Sheryl Crow.
Oh, yeah.
Interesting thing about that is her band at the time, two guys in London, two guys in Atlanta, some people in LA. So
why were they all over like that?
It's just the way it worked out. I don't know. But so you can't just like get the band together for an audition.
Yeah.
So basically they were starting a tour. They had to like have the auditions the day before rehearsal started. And then you just go straight into rehearsals in Nashville.
Yeah.
So dear friend of mine, Brett Simons, great bass player, and I flew out from LA. We had to have visas to go, because we were coming over here to do a show, like 2 weeks into the tour. Bags packed, with all you ready to go on tour. Yeah. Everything ready. But one of you is going to go home.
That's so
and
bizarre.
Another guy, Why Not Jansfield, came out from New York to audition as well. Fantastic. Good friend of mine.
And this, you were auditioning in London?
No, sorry. The auditions were in Nashville.
In Nashville.
So Why Not from New York.
Right,
Brett and
you.
I. Brett and I sitting on the plane across the aisle from each other. And so
you
yeah.
should have another drink. Have another drink.
Oh, man. Yeah, so we all, you know, flew and did the audition. And then, it was like that night.
You got the gig.
Got the gig.
Yeah. Text the guys. Sorry, dudes.
Yeah, well, they're both doing all right. Brett's playing with Chicago now, which is a great gig for him.
Yeah.
Anyway, so back to Roger Daltrey. I just thought that was a funny story with, like, Yeah, because you're friends with, you know, all us bass players in LA. We have, sometimes we have like hangs where we get 20 bass players at a bar and we all hang out. We're all friends.
Amazing.
You know.
So but you got the Daltrey gig.
I did. Yeah. And so I did that for years. Yeah. And then, a couple years back, it was 2017. I guess Pino wasn't going to do the Who tour for whatever reason. And so Roger went to Pete and was like, hey, my guy John's great. Yeah. He's a good guy. He plays all right. He's cool.
Yeah.
He shows up on time.
His
playing's okay. But, you know. And the deal was they had, at the time, they had like a 5 shows over here. Yeah. I think a little short UK tour. And so it was basically like I would do that tour and Pete would see how that went, see if I fit in. That was kind of the audition.
Is he the boss?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, him and Roger.
Yeah.
You know.
But like, but he needs to basically give the thumbs up.
Well, Roger knew me. Roger had been playing with me for 8 years. So he's like, he already gave me the thumbs up. Yeah. But Pete, I hadn't played with Pete.
Got you.
So, yeah.
And what was, did you have to audition? No, you just turned up, did them 5 gigs.
Right.
Yeah.
And then, I'd be like, so, hello, what do you think?
Yeah. And what was the, because it's like a bit, John Entwistle's style was so weird.
Yes.
It was so weird.
So weird.
Like, I've tried to emulate that stuff when I'm like talking about John Entwistle. I'm like, hey, and then I just can never do it. Can you do it?
I don't know.
You probably can.
I don't think so. I mean, I try to do some hybrid of me and whatever that crazy thing he did and just hope
he
for the
best.
He
just hits the notes like,
Does
he hit them around the neck or something?
I don't.
Yeah, that, yeah.
Yeah, it's weird, right?
Yeah,
it's super tiring.
Is it?
That is tiring. 2.5 hours of, you know, it's like, ah.
Yeah, they're rounds as well, aren't they? And he actually played with rounds, didn't he?
Very rounds.
Yeah.
He
was, like the, was he not something to do with the development of rounds or something?
I don't know. Could be. Yeah, but I think he used rotosounds.
Yeah, rotosounds.
Yeah.
I think rotosounds.
And it was like a guitar amp, just like... Ah!
Nick's giving us the nod. He's saying, yeah, I think rotosounds were the first guys that came up with round. That could be a lie. I don't know.
Yeah,
they are now. But I think John Entwistle was like one of the first guys to sort of like, you know, get the round rounds going. Yeah. He was actually the first guy that bi-amped as well. Do you know that...
Yeah.
Yeah. So he was sort of, I had one distorted amp and one. Mm-hmm. Do you do that as well?
I do.
You do? Oh, wow. Yeah. And did you know that going into it? Were you sort of like fully educationed up on the John Entwistle vibe and how to do that?
To an extent, because, you know, with Roger, we do lots of Who stuff.
Right. So it was a
pretty natural bridge from Roger into the Who. Yeah. So I'd already been doing that for a minute.
And when you started playing those lines, did you have to do some research into, had you ever played like that before?
No.
Mm-mm. Not at all.
Not at all. I just kind of figured it out. I mean, I think you just listen and go, God, he must be doing, I mean, I don't really know. I mean, I guess you look at some videos and go, oh, he's up here kind of.
Yeah.
But I think he did like 3 or 4 fingers. He does crazy.
It's cool. Whatever he's doing, it's really, really cool.
Yeah, he's incredible.
Yeah, he was amazing, yeah. And the My Generation thing, right?
Yeah. What about it?
Yeah, do you play it sort of like note for note? Or?
No, not at all.
Not at all?
Never did.
Are you given your sort of like artistic license with it? You can just...
Yeah. I mean, I definitely, it's a tip of the hat to it for sure.
Yeah.
You know.
There's some sort of like key bits, isn't there?
Yeah.
They're like probably the intro or something like that.
Exactly.
And then as you get into it, you can kind of sort of like do your own thing. I think that's what Pino did, actually.
Yeah, and that's what John did.
Is that what John did?
About the Who that's interesting, like playing with them, you know, a lot of other artists, you're like, oh, you got to learn the part off the record, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
The part on the record with the Who, that's what they did that day.
Right,
on that
okay.
take. I mean, Pete's like a jazz musician, man. It's like, he plays stuff different every night. Same with Zach. It's all a moving target.
Yeah.
You know? So those parts are...
Are they just like more of like a guide?
Yeah, totally.
And were you told that going into it?
No. Nobody told me anything.
So you kind of sort of figured it out.
Nobody tells me anything.
Yeah.
It's amazing, I look up online, what songs are they playing on tour right now? I'm serious.
What's the set list?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, just... Yeah, be there. Your flight's at 2. Okay. Yeah. Oh, they play that frequently. Okay. What's the arrangement? YouTube. Okay.
It's interesting, yeah. Isn't it? Yeah. I think that's really telling, because you're actually not being the guy that's saying, hey guys, can I know this? Can I know that? You're actually sort of like putting the work and the onto yeah. yourself
yes.
and doing yeah. the research and yeah. the preparation that you spoke about.
Right.
Get the preparation down first yeah. and make sure that, yeah. Because I think that you can sometimes over-ask as a...
Oh, sure, yeah.
You know, and they're like, oh, this guy's just always asking questions.
Right.
You know, yeah. let's get the guy that doesn't ask questions and he just turns up and he's like super prepared.
Right.
You know, I think there is an element of that, isn't there? Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So what are you doing now? What are you actually doing? Like, obviously you're on tour with The Who. Is it a world tour?
Yeah. Well, so we did about a month of... Well, right now we're doing a tour with full orchestra.
Which it's is a full orchestra.
45-piece orchestra, I think. Oh, but yeah. pickup orchestras.
Yeah.
Different orchestra in every city.
Oh, nice.
Is that, speaking of sight reading.
I was going to say, does that add more stress to the... It's easier travel, but you know, like playing with a different orchestra.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's stressful for the conductor that travels with us.
Yeah.
That has to rehearse the orchestra. But these orchestras, you know, we're playing in big cities like
yeah.
London.
Yeah.
You know, you get the best.
Are you just getting the best orchestra? Conductor's got it. The conductor's the same guy, right?
Conductor travels with us. We also have a first violinist and a first cellist.
Right, okay.
So they can kind of like, hey, Roger just played four extra bars. So we're doing this orchestra tour, which is an interesting thing, because for the fans that have seen The Who 95 times, it's like a different thing.
Yeah.
So we just did a month in the States. And then we did one show here last night, which is probably why my voice is like ragged and I'm half asleep. And then we do another 2 months in the States, and then nobody tells me anything, so I'm hearing rumors from fans about what we're doing next year.
Fans know. Yeah, what we do next year.
Exactly.
Amazing.
Yeah, so I think we're coming back. I shouldn't say anything because it might not be announced yet. I don't know. I'm getting in trouble.
It'll be fine. In terms of gear, what are you using on the gig?
This.
That is the bass going into...
Since it's an orchestra tour,
yeah.
we have to keep the stage volume down because there's 45 condenser mics, some of which are 3 feet from me.
Wow.
So I can't use an SVT and a guitar amp.
Which is what you normally use.
What I had been doing. Yeah. So in the past, I had kind of a Marshall-style guitar amp that was won by a company called Sur. That's a lower wattage. It's just like a 15-watt Marshall.
Oh, yeah.
And then an SVT, and I just run those both.
Yeah.
Both of them full range, and just off you go.
Cranking, yeah.
It's great.
And really what are you doing on this one, then?
So for this one, Zach's playing electric drums. Yeah.
How's that going?
Right. Amazing, actually.
Does he like it?
Yeah, he's cool with it. And you know what he did? He, I believe...
Is it the Roland, the ones that are like...
Yeah. Yes. But so he had those put into drum shells, so it looks like a regular drum kit.
Oh, wow.
But that's the cool amazing. Thing is that apparently, hopefully I don't have this wrong, I'm pretty sure he sampled his kit.
Right, okay, yeah.
And so he's triggering... He's not using the Roland built-in...
Yeah. Stuff.
Yeah, he's using a sample of SDS-7s.
Yeah.
No, it's his drum kit. I think it sounds.
And
it sounds
is there
great
any difference? I was going
to
say, is there any difference for you? Would you?
Yes.
There is, yeah.
It was an adjustment for a minute. There's something about when there's air moving or something. But I just the first couple of days of rehearsal were like, oh, that's an adjustment. But now it's totally fine. I totally don't even think about it.
And what are you?
95%
of
the time.
Using?
I'm using a Line 6 Helix.
Oh, see, a lot of guys use them, actually. And are you just going direct?
I go into the Noble.
Yeah.
The Noble DI.
Yeah.
I do that first.
Everybody loves the Nobles.
It's good.
Let's talk about gear in a second.
Yeah, all right.
But yeah.
Well, we're talking about gear.
Yeah, so.
But we can talk about that gear in a second.
Yeah.
I'm using the Helix, and basically I, you know, kind of emulate my real rig with, so I've got an SVT.
Yeah.
And I've got a Marshall, and I can send those out separately, separate outputs to the house.
Yeah. And there's no amp.
I do have an amp. I have a PF50.
Right, okay, yeah.
Which is the all tube Ampeg like 50-watt thing.
Yeah.
And two of the 210 little guys stacked up.
Yeah, just to give
but it's
you
just
a
monitor.
Bit.
I'm on in ears, so
I was
gonna
say you've got
in
ears, yeah.
But for the orchestra, because otherwise they're just like there's no sound on. They'll hear Pete, and yeah. and they'll hear Zach sounds like this.
And that's all they'll hear.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's so bizarre, isn't it? Because yeah, because are they monitored? They must have monitors, are they?
They've got headphones for a few of, like, the first player of each section.
Right. Okay.
Has a headphone.
Yeah.
I don't know what's in that. There's drums, I think, and maybe click for some of the ones we use click.
Right, got you. What do you use click for?
A lot of those Who songs have sequences.
Right? Okay, yeah.
I mean, that's like the sound of the Who, you know?
Yeah.
Who Are You and Bob O'Reilly.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Which is wild because those are not in time.
They're not in time?
Well, it's an old analog synth.
Got
so
you.
The.
Yeah. But the click's in time.
Well, the click chases.
Yeah. Wow. I suppose you just get used to it, right?
You have to learn.
Bit of elasticity there.
Mm.
Yeah. And in terms of like your studio gear of when you're turning to a session, what's your, obviously you've got your 64p bass.
65,
wasn't there any of that? 65p bass. What else do you turn up with?
Oh boy. How long do you guys...
do you turn up with a ton of stuff?
I bring way too much stuff always. Because I sort of have this feeling of like, how hard is it for me to go put that in the van compared to, I'm at a session, this would sound so great with that thing that's how silly is that?
So what, do you take all your, not all your bases, but sort of like a collection?
I usually bring, so I bring this, I have a 59, I think, with flats and the foam P-bass, you know?
Yeah.
I have a Hofner. I have a Harmony H22.
Oh, yeah.
Which is just killer. So those are the main dudes I usually bring. Sometimes I'll bring my Rickenbacker that has flats.
Yeah.
I have a Hagstrom F100 that I'll bring sometimes because it's just weird
cool.
Yeah, those are usually the main bases. If I need, I have a Lakeland 5-string.
Active. To do that thing.
Yeah. If that's needed, which is almost never.
Yeah.
I have a Lakeland fretless as well, which never.
Yeah, never.
Happens. And then I have a really nice upright. So sometimes that'll come.
Yeah. And what about amps?
B15, 1965. Yeah. Yep. Always bring that. And then I have the Noble DI. And I put together this crazy two pedal board rig. So I have my Noble DI and I've got a couple of switches. One will turn on a loop to put effects in. And then the other one can move whether that effects loop is only in the amp or in the amp and the DI.
Got you. Yeah.
And then I've got a big old pedal board with like five different distortions and a H9. You know, the whatever.
Well, who makes them H9s again? Yeah, the...
I'm such an idiot. Anyone?
Google it.
Eventide.
Right?
Eventide.
They're going to kill me. Eventide H9 and just all kinds of, you know, a chorus and the microsynth.
Just
all kinds of silly stuff, which I mostly use for in-between takes to crack people up.
Wouldn't it be cool if we had this effect? If you were on a desert island and it could take only one bass, which one would it be?
This. That's my life, actually.
Really, yeah.
Is this desert island bass.
What percentage of the tracks?
99.
Really?
Like, well, lately I've been using the 50s with the flats a lot. But as far as like, if I had to pick one, it's this.
T-bass with rounds.
No, this one.
That one.
And it drives me crazy because I've tried to find backup, something else. Because what happens is, like, I'm coming to do this one gig in London, and they put our gear over on a boat, right?
And that has to go.
No. If I shipped it, it'd take a month, but I need it for every gig, you know, every session I do in LA. I have to have this. So I'm, you know, woe's me. I have to lug it around myself.
And it's so heavy.
but you put, you know, I put this in this like ginormous case that you could throw off a building because that's what they do.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I can't do the like carry it on because I'm just like, what if somebody puts a hat on top of it.
Yeah, yeah,
and then it'll break. And then, you know, so.
And what is it about this bass?
I don't know.
Is it the resonance? Is it just the way?
I think it's a couple of things. I think one, so when I bought this somewhere in the mid to late 90s in LA, that was back in the day.
Yeah,
in the olden days, where there were guitar shops.
Yeah.
There were like 5 or 6 vintage guitar shops in Hollywood.
Yeah.
And so I went to all of them and played all of the P basses.
Really?
And I liked this one.
Yeah.
So I bought this one. And so not only was it a good one for me that I liked the sound of or whatever, but also I've just played this so much, being that it's my desert island bass.
Yeah.
I've used it for everything.
Yeah.
It's just become home. You know, I know every nook and cranny of it.
Yeah.
So it's
just
comfort, you know, it's my little blankie.
Yeah. It's got a detune on it as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you use it much?
All the time.
Do you use it all the time? Yeah. Just like knock it down to the deer.
Oh yeah. All the time.
Amazing.
Well, also because I frequently use this for, you know, I'll go do, like I played with a big Japanese singer for a while. And I'd fly over with just this, and there was songs that had
you might need low, a five string for, but because you've got this.
Yeah, same with On the Who, I do, what is it? Eminence Front.
Right,
It's down to C sharp.
Yeah. Oh, Jesus.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because part of my thinking is, from the front of house, like I find that the front of house guy will get a sound for this bass, and then if I go, oh, I gotta pick up a five string,
he really doesn't want you to change bass, does he?
Also, it's just he's gonna get that sound, and it's gonna sound good. And I've seen shows where guys are swapping basses every song,
yeah,
and it's like that one sounded good, but the other 9. I can't even hear.
Yeah, so the engineer is set up for that. Yeah.
Stay on that one that sounded good. You know, so I feel like for the front of house, just to be consistent, and also for everybody's monitor and everything, just to have one and get this sounding really good and just stick with it.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, and not normally, aren't they? Really, P basses. They just got it first time. Got it right the first time around, didn't they?
Yeah, and I don't know. You know, I don't know how much of it is that this was right and the great thing, or if because this was so prevalent that we just became acclimated to this being good because we always heard it.
Yeah, I've heard that, you know what I mean? The time. I don't think it is.
No.
Well, I've heard people talk about it. I get it. And I totally understand, because that's what obviously engineers and everybody said. If you don't know, guys, like a lot of people say that, you know, the reason why we think P basses sound great is because we've heard them for years.
It's not only that.
But it's like they just feel great to play. And
well, there's that. Also, a big part of it, I think you talked about this with Sean Hurley, is the P bass has kind of a narrow
dynamic response.
Frequency range,
Frequency range, yeah.
And so it kind of like sits in this spot where it's not getting in the way of all these, you know, if you get this bass that sounds like a grand piano, you're taking up this frequency range and you're getting in the way of the kick drum and the guitars and the cymbals and, you know.
Yeah.
Whereas if you have this kind of more narrow, kind of simpler sound.
Yeah.
It has like a little window to go in.
And just slots right in.
Here I am. You know?
Here's Johnny.
It's not. And it's not getting in the way of everything, getting masked by, you know, all kinds of other
sounds. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm a huge fan. I'm a huge fan. John, where do we send people if they want to come and harass you online?
JohnButton.com.
JohnButton.com.
There you go.
J-O-N.
Oh,
J-O-N.
Yeah.
J-O-N.
And Button singular.
And are you on Facebook and
all that stuff?
Instagram.
What am I on Instagram? I think I'm John Button Bass.
Yeah.
On
they'll
Instagram.
Find they'll find you. Thank you so much, man.
It's my honor. I'm a fan of your whole site. It's amazing. Yeah.
Oh, you're too kind.
I'm signed up. I have a membership.
Get out of town.
No, absolutely.
Heard it here.
Yeah.
Cheers, man. Oh. I'll shake hands twice for that. Take it easy, man. See you later, guys. Bye.